Bruce is here with this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. Hello again, Bruce.
Hello, Rex. Well, I love that intro music. I just got a new guitar new to me the other day, and while my guitar gently weeps, I love it.
Yeah, so you got a 12-string, huh?
Yeah, I have another 12-string that's a 1960 Epiphone Serenader, but it's a small body, and I've wanted a larger body one for a long time. Been looking for a couple of years and found a beauty down in store in Massachusetts and had it shipped up, and it's been great. It's been a lot of fun. My fingers are more sore than they would be if I'd been playing that much 6-string, but it's a great little guitar. I like it.
How much more difficult is it to play 12-string?
It's not much more difficult. They're a lot harder to tune, and one of the problems is the guitars of the 60s, the great guitars that were made, 12-strings made in the 60s, the Guilds and the Gibsons and the Martins of that period, some have what are called tail pieces, and that's a metal piece. Mine has that. They're a little harder to tune, a little harder to maintain than the others. But once you get the hang of it, it isn't really difficult, except if you're barring chords. And then it's a little more difficult because you're trying to use one finger to keep 12 strings flat, you know, or the bulk of them. But it's not any different. What it is the right hand. It's the attack that's different, because they can be overwhelmingly loud if you don't have a good right hand. I used to play a lot of 12 string when I was performing, because they really cut through a room. You know, if I was playing a club as opposed to a listening room, but it isn't really much different to play them.
Very interesting. Well, so is the book you're going to talk about this week. Yeah. We've chatted about it a couple times. Tell us what you thought of Al Clark's book, Called Out But Safe.
Well, it really took me by surprise. This is a really unflinching memoir. Al Clark had a great life, and then he had a couple of years where things that, as a result of things he did, didn't go well for him. But he's a really interesting kid. I mean, it was interesting as a child. He really wanted to be a baseball player, but as he said, a catcher with no arm who can't hit doesn't have much of a future in baseball. And he played other sports. He grew up in New Jersey. He played PAL baseball with Bob Ryan. And he tells us his version of the story squares with Bob's. Bob was throwing batting practice, and one got away, and he boinked Al in the head. But they've remained friends over the years. But he was a guy who early on knew he wanted to be an umpire. And his rise was, if not meteoric, uncommonly swift, because he was very highly regarded. He worked his way up from the minors in a very short period of time. He spent some time in Venezuela, where he learned that when they scream kill the umpire, they don't really mean that, though he thought that's what was going to happen to him. And he has a number of firsts. He was not the longest serving umpire, but he was there for 26 years. He was the first Jewish umpire in the American League, and the first guy to have his name on his hat. No other umpire has ever had Al on his hat.
Yeah, well, yes.
But here are just a few of the things that he was part of. He was behind the plate for Nolan Ryan's 300th win. He was in Baltimore when Cal Ripken broke the streak. He was in San Francisco when the earthquake hit. For me, one of the greatest moments ever in sport, he was there when Bucky Dent hit a home run up into the left field screen.
Bruce, we're losing you. Is there a problem with your laptop?
We'll live forever with Yankee fans. But because he was such an outgoing guy, and because he was such a good umpire, all around baseball, he was a beloved guy. He didn't have a lot of problems with managers. He tells some funny stories about when managers wanted to be thrown out, and he sort of made them earn it. And that he was not a person who tossed a lot of people out. He also blows up some of the myths about what'll get you run. There are a lot of people that think there's a magic word or two. And he goes, no, not necessarily. It depends how you use it. what's really good is his dad was a sports writer for the Trenton paper, and a diehard Yankees fan, a diehard Giants fan, you know, a New York guy, even though Trenton is closer to Philly than it is to New York. So he grew up with a dad who was a committed writer, and he thought at one point in time he might want to be a writer. And he did indeed spend some of his early life also was a sports writer. So he comes to the idea of telling a story from both the journalist perspective, give me the facts, the inverted pyramid, all that, and because he's a natural raconteur, he knows how to deliver the story that way. And he got help from somebody he's known a long time, the longtime sports writer and author Dan Schlossberg. Some of the testimonies for the book were great. I was pleased that Al Clark was the home plate umpire in my 300th win, and even more pleased when he gave me the lineup card afterward. I've always considered him a good umpire and a good guy. Nolan Ryan was not known for liking any umpires. In fact, a couple of umpires say Nolan Ryan never threw a ball in his life. Ron Bloomberg said, Al Clark never threw me out of a game, but Billy Martin wasn't so fortunate. I not only witnessed his confrontations with Al, but enjoyed remembering them in this book. And he talks a lot about when certain managers were, and he would have a word we couldn't use on the air, but he would say they weren't very nice guys. But he, for the most part, talks about how you have to let everything roll off your back if you're going to be a good umpire. And he talks about the pitchers that he called, and he talked about the who he thought were real pros. But then he makes a mistake, and he makes a minor violation of American League rules regarding changing flights. We'll let Al talk about that because we will have him on. He sent me his cell phone number today and said to call him to set up. And that got him tossed out of baseball. And when he got tossed out of baseball, that's what he did. You know, he'd been an umpire forever and a good one. He was thrown out of baseball for, you know, next to nothing, in part because he would argue, I think, and convincingly, that some of his support for the union may not have been ingratiated him to the powers that be in baseball, especially Bud Selig and some of the others who came afterwards. So he started making money other ways. And one of the things he did was certify baseballs that had been used in certain games that he had umpired. Unfortunately, he certified some he shouldn't, and the judge decided to make an example of him, and Al had to go to a minimum security prison for a number of months, which he doesn't hide from. He doesn't excuse his behavior. He talks about it openly and honestly, and it really shows you that he's a guy who could really look at he could find the positive in everything, even found the positive in that experience. He didn't enjoy the experience by any means, but it's just a very frank book, and it's very, very well written. I think anybody who wonders what it would like to be a professional umpire at that level, or I think probably in any sport, official in any sport, this is a really interesting book. I expected it to be maybe just full of anecdotes about famous people, and God knows there are tons of those. But there's also a lot about his personal life and what it was like to move up that quickly, to become at a very young age, for instance, be a crew chief with older umpires, and what it's like the day of games for umpires, things that I really didn't know much about. And the fact that once he was in the umpire room and he had to throw his own father out because he was asking questions Al didn't want to answer. So it's a really, really fascinating book.
Excellent. That's called Out But Safe.
Yeah. On a Baseball Umpire's Journey, with the foreword is by Marty Appel, who's the long, long time historian of the New York Yankees. You know, we have our historian of the Boston Red Sox that you speak to regularly. That would be, he'd be the guy for the Yankees. And he wrote the foreword and said some really complimentary things about Al. And I think he'll be a lot of fun to talk to because he's a great storyteller.
Excellent. Looking forward to that. What else have we got coming up in the next few weeks on Sports Lit?
We got some good stuff here. We have two books. We have a book coming up that I'm really excited about called Red Sox and Fives and Tens.
Oh, this is the Bill Nolan book?
Yeah, it's the Bill Nolan book. Man, Rich, I've got when we get off air, I've got to figure out how to get all these books to you, because this book, you're never going to give this back to me. I'm going to have to get Rosemary to send me another one. It is, it's just great. And you don't have to be a diehard Red Sox fan to love this book. I mean, I'm not, and I was fascinated by this, because it's a real thinking man's guide to making a list. You know, people like to talk, who's the greatest of all time and this and that. It's more interesting to say, who are the five players that had the best season at first base for the Boston Red Sox? Who are the 10 players that had the best postseason pitching performances? And a lot of guys that you know, all the people you think will show up do, but a lot of people from the shadows who had one or two outstanding years sort of come back to visit. And it was really, really, really fun. And, you know, there's little facts in here, like the last of Bill Buckner's 174 home runs was when he hit at the age of 41. You know what made it interesting? It was an inside the park home run, and he already had the bad knees and ankles.
I remember that.
Right. See, as I'm saying, you're going to love this book, because so much of this that I didn't know, I think you're going to go, oh, well, of course. But you might also include, because it's really for someone that loves baseball history and loves the Red Sox. That's just really, really, really great. And it's not only the best of, but it's the worst seasons that people had. And, you know, like Kevin Youkilis, one year had a really bad year in the fielding department, but still was a productive member of the team. So you get a lot of insights into that. And then after that, we're going to have Will Gehagan on from who wrote Baseball Nation about the wooden bat leagues. And then we have Aaron Pribble on from Baseball in the Promised Land. And then Al Clark. I know, then Bill Nolan. And then I think Al Clark.
And have we got Brad Baluchian lined up? Because I finished The Wax Pack, and my gosh, that was a wonderful book.
We don't, but now I was going to ask you that. Knowing that, I will contact them today and get her lined up. Yeah, as Chad Finn said the other day, it's the book you kick yourself. Why didn't I think of this?
Right.
Why didn't I do? I mean, it's the simplest of ideas. And yeah, what didn't you love the way he interwove his own life and the things he was going through with that trip? I thought it was just marvelously done.
Oh, absolutely. And just, you know, to find out the lives of some of these players and to realize that, you know, even 34 years ago when these guys were playing, how much the world of professional sports has changed even since then for most of those guys who all largely had to go out and find real jobs.
Yeah, and you know what I thought was really great was the way that some of them stayed in baseball and some of them said, no, that's over. I'm going to do something else completely different. But when he brought them back to baseball, it was as if they were kids again. You know, I felt I'm spacing the guy's name, the pitcher that he so admired.
Don Carmen.
Carmen. I kept wanting to say Don Dorman. Don Carmen. I thought that there were some of the most touching scenes in that book were the two of them talking. I'm thinking Don Carmen probably didn't have a lot of kids in New England who thought he was their favorite player. You know, that was very cool.
Yeah, and the story of the guy who I think had the shortest career of all the guys he talked with, former pitcher Jaime Coconauer. What a wonderful story he was.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking too about how this is really, in a sense, a very American story because it crisscrosses the country. It's a lot like the one about him where he sang the national anthem and all the minor league parks.
Oh, yes.
Which I can probably see from my desk if I look over there and put my glasses on, but it doesn't make a difference. You know, the way it was, part of it was he traveled everywhere. He went to all those places. Summer Baseball Nation is very much the same way, where he sees games in Alaska, California, the East Coast of Virginia, the way that he comes to New England and moves around, because baseball is that one game that's played everywhere.
Absolutely. Good stuff.
Yeah. Some really good stuff. I this has been one of the best groups of books we've gotten in a really long time.
It's good, because we need it more than ever these days.
Boy, I guess. I mean, I can't believe how much I've been reading. I've been reading manuscripts for friends and reading other books and working with my kids by email, which drives me crazy. You know, I think, are you finding the hardest thing is if you're in a classroom and you ask a question and nobody raises their hand, you rephrase the question,
right?
Yep. Or you eventually you maybe rephrase it a third time. Now, when you're doing it by writing, you're writing everything out. You just pick the best way and then hope they get it. It's been very frustrating. I want my kids in my classroom.
It's a challenge. And I know, man, I didn't have power for 4 days. A lot of my students were without power for several days. And when that's what you've got, then you're not going to have work. And I had, when I finally got my power back, I was greeted with a barrage of emails from students who had turned things in late. And I said, look, don't worry about it. Because even if they were in on time, I didn't have access to them. But that's
right. I had one kid ask if she could have a day extra. And I said, the truth be known, I can't read and correct all these in one day anyway.
Right.
And I basically I made assignments pretty much try and get them done by. You know, I'm not done on because a lot of kids are trying to catch up. They didn't have power for days. They didn't have internet. And they've got professors that are maybe a little bit less tolerant of the situation, shall we say. We wouldn't say they're being idiots, but they might be. So I'm just trying to give them a break and give them as much as I can.
That's all you can do. Absolutely.